This is Greg Palast, author of Vulture's Picnic, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, your weapon of mass instruction in the beating heart of America.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
Good morning and welcome to Tell Somebody. This is your host, Tom Clammer, and today on Tell Somebody, we have former CIA analyst Ray McGovern in the studio to kick off a tour of Missouri and a little stop in Lawrence, Kansas. Find more information at www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now. And if you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. And we'll get to Ray in just a minute, but I want you to mark your calendar and tell your friends. Like I said, Ray is taking another whistle stop tour all over Missouri, culminating in a talk at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on Monday, April 7th. And you can RSVP for that event on the events pages of www.kclibrary.org. And Ray will be speaking in Lawrence, Kansas tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the Ecumenical Campus Ministries. And that's 1204 Oread Avenue in Lawrence, Kansas. And we'll get to that in just a minute, but wanted to let you know that last week's podcast with Richard Tripp, director and founder of Care of Poor People, Inc., and he was talking on the show last week about the Saturday, April 19th, Spring Break for the Homeless. And that podcast has been posted. You can get links to stream or download the audio at www.tellsomebody.us. And Richard could use your help pulling this off. If you're interested in volunteering to help the homeless with Richard Tripp, go to www.coppinc.com. And be sure to tune in next week on Tell Somebody. You can hear a conversation I have on the phone via Delhi, India, with ecological activist and author Vandana Shiva about her upcoming visit to Kansas City on April 17th and 18th. More information at www.cultivatekc.org or by listening to this show next Thursday, April 3rd, right after Democracy Now! Friends of Community Media will join with KC Move to Amend and the All Souls Forum to present Free Press co-founder Professor Robert McChesney talking about Dollarocracy. That's Sunday morning, April 6th, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut. More information at www.ourfcm.org. And keep an ear to this station for upcoming announcements. And David Cobb, co-founder and spokesperson for Move to Amend, will be speaking at UMKC Tuesday evening, April 22nd. Look for KC Move to Amend on Facebook for more information. On with the show, Ray McGovern, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be back.
Well, it's great to have you. This is the first time of the many times you've been on this show that I've had you in person. But it's good to see you. Just a quick note here. There's a woman in Springfield, Missouri, named Sue Skidmore, who is kind of responsible for introducing Ray McGovern to Missouri. She had him come to the state several years ago and tour all over Missouri, and that's how I first met him, and she has done it again, and I'm glad she did. But Ray, you have had a busy week, and a month or so ago you were in England at a at the Oxford Union giving an award long distance to Edward Snowden after meeting him last fall in Moscow, but it didn't let up after Oxford. What's been going on with you the last week or so?
Well, it has been sort of hectic, Tom, but good hectic, if I could put it that way. We've been very, very active since October 9th when we awarded Edward Snowden in Moscow the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence. More recently, in February, we were back in the Oxford Union awarding Chelsea Manning the same award, which we could not give her or him prior to now because, obviously, when there was some doubt as to whether she would plead guilty or not, we weren't about to give her an award for having done so courageously what she did. More recently, Jeremy Scahill, my good friend, gave me an email, actually, 10 days ago and said, Ray, I'm unable to go to the film festival in The Hague where Dirty Wars, my film, is being honored. Would you substitute for me? Now, there are a few people in the world that I would rather impersonate than Jeremy Scahill, and so I said yes right off the bat. I got substitutes for two other talks I was to give, and it was an incredible experience. These films that were shown at The Hague were incredibly instructive. I learned a lot, and then I had a chance to hold forth after each showing of Dirty Wars, which again was a welcome opportunity. I could tell these folks from Europe what was going on in the United States. I won't say they were shocked. Well, yeah, maybe I will say they were shocked. And my appeal to them was this. I said, you know, my father's generation drove fascists out of Europe. We in the United States don't have any real experience of living under fascism. Right now, we are experiencing what I call creeping fascism, where the multinational corporations, where the government, where the security services, which are largely penetrated by contractors, namely the multinational corporations, where the media, which are largely controlled by the corporations, where parts of our legislature, witness the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is supposed to be overseeing and in reality is overlooking these transgressions against our Constitution, witness parts of the judiciary, those 15 what I call faux lawyers, faux judges on the so-called FISA court, a secret court in violation of everything that our founders stood for. And then, you know, look at the other things that are going on, and you'll see that for the first time in my life, you have enmeshed, entangled all these elements of a situation that Benito Mussolini described as fascism. And so I said to these Europeans, look, you know what it's like. We don't. Any perceptive observer can see what's going on in our country. Illegal laws. Now, people say, now McGovern, for God's sake, that's an oxymoron. You can't have an illegal law. Well, you can, okay? A law that's against our Constitution, which I took a solemn oath to support and defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic, you can have illegal laws against that Constitution. Hitler had very legal laws, but they were against the Weimar Constitution. So what I'm saying here is that when you have illegal laws, it always takes a, well, let's say, a judiciary with integrity. It takes them several years to catch up and say, yep, whoops, yeah, you're right, those laws are illegal, strike them off the book. Gross violations of the Fourth Amendment, for example, against unreasonable searches and seizures by the NSA, of course they're illegal. You can't square them with the Fourth Amendment. The only problem is it is a hiatus there. There are several years where the government, to the degree it wishes to, can violate the Constitution by passing and executing illegal laws. So I explained all this to my predominantly Dutch audience, and they didn't know much of it. Their press is very much like ours, controlled by corporations who profiteer on things like war, okay? And so I said, look, we drove fascists out of this continent. It's your turn, right? It's your turn. Somebody needs to act like a friend. You know, when a fellow is driving drunk, a real friend will take the wheel, okay? And I'm not saying you can take the wheel from the leaders of our country, but what you can do is stand up and mention, those of you with some gray in your hair, you can mention what happened here, okay? Can mention what happened with lists, for example. You know very painfully that when the Nazis came into this country, the Netherlands, there were lists. There were lists of all the citizens in each municipality, in each small town. And there was a column there that said religion. And if there was a J under that list, mayors faced a crisis of conscience because they knew what would happen if those lists were given to the Nazis. The ones that wanted to accommodate the Nazis and maybe stay in office and prosper, they gave those lists to the Nazis, and those Jews were immediately transported to Auschwitz and other places to their peril. The ones that had a conscience, and that's why I appeal to you, you Dutch and you Europeans that have a conscience, you need to burn those lists, okay? Just as the ones in the Netherlands at the time did burn those lists, and those Jews were not found. They were not sent to concentration camps. So what am I saying? I'm asking you Europeans, I'm asking you Dutch, prick our conscience, okay? Tell us what happened and warn us and let us know that when you see a driver driving drunk, you're not going to just stand by. You're going to try to take the wheel, or at least to influence and maybe step on the brake so that we can know that the danger is real and that we can stop before full-fledged fascism enters our country.
The voice you're hearing is former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. In the studio with me here on KKFI, Ray is kicking off a tour all over Missouri, and we'll be speaking at the Kansas City Public Library on Monday, April 7th at 6:30 p.m., the Plaza Branch. And Ray, this thing about lists, it just, what crept into my head while you were talking about that, you know, a lot of people toss out these Nazi or fascist comparisons or warnings lightly and in different ways as just kind of word bombs. But I remember hearing that when the CIA engineered an overthrow of a democratically elected government in the 1950s in Iran, that there were lists of who to go after, facilitated by U.S. intelligence people, if I'm not mistaken. And the same thing in, I don't know if it was just East Timor or...
It was Indonesia as a whole.
Indonesia as a whole, again, with American culpability there. And, you know, you referenced Mussolini's definition of fascism, government in bed with big corporations. So there are some lightly grounded attacks, word bombs about fascism, but there is some solid basis for some of them too, yes?
Yeah, my friends, you know, they've told me for years now, Ray, what did you do? Don't use the F word, you know. Now, I thought they meant the four-letter F word, okay? But they told me, look, Ray, no, we mean the F for fascism word. I said, why? And they said, well, if you want to be called anti-Semitic, people will say that you're denying the Holocaust. People will say that they identify the Holocaust with fascism, and they can't seem to separate them out. So if you start talking about fascism and you don't realize how people will say, well, wait a second, this fellow may be against the Holocaust or may think that it's not real, so don't even raise it. Well, you know, I'm very reluctant to raise it. I mean, I'm 75 almost years old. I've been very proud to serve my country as an officer and the U.S. Army. But what I see now, if we just limit it to lists, of course the lists are made available by the giant telecoms, and the giant telecoms were held innocent for their crimes against the Fourth Amendment in 2008, when our current president was a senator, and who decided, when he said, hold these people innocent for violating our rights under the Fourth Amendment, never would I do that. And then as he was running for president, he said, I think I'll change my mind on that. Yeah, nobody should pay a price for, cooperating with the government. And of course, General Hayden, who was running the NSA, he was just doing what Dick Cheney said. So the fact that he violated his oath to protect the Constitution, including the Fourth Amendment, well, let's hold them all innocent. That was my first clue, Tom. That was my very first clue that this fellow Obama was not what he made himself out to be. And I've been scandalized watching since, as either he accommodated or he actually supported what's been going on in this country. The most recent example, of course, are these, what I call these lists on steroids, these lists of all our calls, all our emails. You talk about lists. Well, we've got lists on steroids now. J. Edgar Hoover would be out of his gourd thinking about what he could do to us now. And it was precisely what he was doing that we passed laws against in the 70s. And now those laws have been played fast and loose with.
Indeed. And, Ray, I hope you and the listeners will forgive me if I hop around here a little bit. But I want to talk a little bit about Ukraine, among other things. I've got a copy of Tuesday's Kansas City Star here with which carried a column by Charles Krauthammer, Mr. President, Show Putin Some Seriousness. And he says, why did we deny Ukraine weapons? Because President Barack Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry's worldview, arming the victim, might be taken as a provocation. This kind of mind-bending illogical has marked the administration's response to the whole Crimean affair. And Krauthammer makes some fun about what he calls a White House phrase to de-escalation and on an off-ramp. And then says, did they actually think Putin was losing? It's delusional enough to think that Putin was actually losing in what he's doing and blah, blah, blah. Basically taking him to task for being way too soft when he thinks he should rattle some sabers and so forth. I heard you, I think, in the days just before the election they had in Crimea about that ended up with 97% in favor of going back to the Russian ship. Yeah, surprise, surprise. But you were talking, I think this was on CCC TV or something, but you were talking about an off-ramp that could have been provided ahead of that election or in connection with it or something. A little more seriously than this baloney that the White House proposed and Krauthammer ridicules. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes. Tom, I have to say that everyone's entitled to their own opinion. My opinion of Krauthammer is that he's not a serious person. He would never adduce, for example, what's at the core of all these troubles with Ukraine, and that is NATO. Now, we have a little time, Tom. Usually I'm doing 6-minute sound bites, So let me go back and tell you what it was like.
Yes, please.
When I was, my undergraduate and graduate degrees were in Russian history and language. I taught the language for a while, and I was immersed in Russian history and Soviet experience for my 27 years as an analyst in the CIA. Toward the end of that time, it was very exciting to watch this new fellow, Gorbachev, come into the fore and supervise the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Now, in 1990, just as I retired, I took early retirement for a whole bunch of reasons. But just as I was retired, the Soviet Union imploded. And, man, I tell you, that was a downer, you know? There's nothing worse than being a real expert on a country that doesn't exist anymore, okay? Now, in a more serious vein, that was probably the most important event in my lifetime. And why do I say that? Because there was an incredible chance for peace in the world. Real peace. Now, people call me a peacenik. I served in the U.S. Army as an infantry and intelligence officer. What I'm saying here is that when the Berlin Wall fell, and when on the other side of the Berlin Wall you had a person like Mikhail Gorbachev, Shevardnadze, his foreign minister, who had supervised the dissolution of this totalitarian state and were willing to make deals with the West, we blew it. How do I say that? Well, you'll remember, most of you, that the Berlin Wall fell in November of 1989. What was going to happen? The Russians had 20 divisions in East Germany. Were they going to use those divisions to suppress not only what happened in East Germany, but elsewhere, what was happening, people taking their cue from the East Germans and revolting? It was a clear and present danger. So what happened? George H.W. Bush, to his credit, went to Malta, that little island in the Mediterranean, and met Gorbachev. And he said, in effect, you know, I've been watching the TV about that wall, you know, and I'm sorry about all that, but, you know, I tell you what, Mikhail, we're not going to take advantage of that. I mean, you got real troubles there. We're not going to, in Bush's words, we're going to not dance on your wall, okay? But in return for that, Mikhail, what we require is that you not use your security forces, your army, to suppress the rest of the democratic evolution in Eastern Europe. It's a deal, Gorbachev said. It's a deal. Send your foreign minister, send your secretary of state to meet with us, and we'll work it all out. In February, so we're talking November, December, January, 3 months later, Jim Baker, George H.W. Bush's secretary of state, shows up in Moscow. And he deals with Gorbachev, okay? And they say, can we put our approval on this deal? And what Baker says is, well, you know, we got to make sure that you're not going to cause trouble in Germany. Now, Germany, for those of you who have a little gray in your hair, maybe you feel like I did at the time. I didn't want to see a reunited Germany. And the Russians, you know, I lived in Germany for 5 years. I love some of the German people, but I didn't want to see a reunited. Now, that went in spades for every Russian that well knew that 25 million, count them, okay, 25 million Russians perished during World War II, and that it was the Soviet Union that bore the brunt of the Nazi offensive, and they resent till this day that the U.S. and the rest of the West came in so late in the war. Okay, whether that's justified or not, that's their resentment, okay? So, here we are with a situation where the Russians don't want a reunited Germany. We don't either. But we can, by saying that a reunited Germany would stay in NATO, there would be restraints. There would be, for example, no possibility that a reunited Germany would develop a nuclear weapon. That was big, okay? So the promise was made. Look, Gorbachev, you take your 20 divisions out of East Germany, okay? And we're going to have a reunited Germany, but they'll stay in NATO. They won't be the threat. And in return for that, we want you not to try to repress what's going on in the rest of Eastern Europe. And we promise, and this was Jim Baker, we promise not to move NATO 1 inch farther to the east. Now, don't take McGovern's word for that. Jack Matlock, the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, was there. He attests to that. Genscher, the German foreign minister, he attests to that. Gorbachev, of course, attests to that. So what happened? Well, Bill Clinton came in, and someone told him, Bill, you have to look a little stronger here. The Russians are on their back. They can't possibly do anything about it. So why don't we move NATO toward Russia and incorporate some of these, what we used to call East European satellite states? Yeah, we think the Baltic states are ripe for plucking. So we'll expand NATO, but we won't include Russia, of course, because, what's the because there? Well, if we keep this semi-Cold War going, when we liberate, in quotes, all these other countries, there's going to be a real demand for providing arms, providing defense support against the Soviet threat, no, the Soviet Union, against the Russian threat, no, well, just because, okay, just because. And so it happened, okay. Now, Russia was in no position to contest that, okay? But they have a historic fear of people on their southern and immediate western border, like Georgia in the Caucasus, like the Ukraine. And NATO, in its wisdom, 6 years ago, said, Georgia and Ukraine are going to be members of NATO. Now, did I make that up? No. This was an official statement out of the Bucharest top leaders of NATO saying, yep, Georgia and Ukraine are going to be part of NATO. Wow. Well, Putin's no longer presiding over Russia supine on its back. He's presiding over a Russia that's coming into its own, okay? And he makes it clear in Georgia 6 years ago, forget about it, forget about it. You're not going to encroach on our soft underbelly, okay? Now, just as a kind of an aside here, you have to appreciate that Russia really came into its own the same time the United States was founded at the end of the 18th century when Catherine the Great extended Russian rule down to and including, guess where, Ukraine and Crimea, okay? That was the beginning of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, the warm water port that would give them a navy, okay? So this is not something new. The Russians have always felt very, very tender about what happened on their southern and their immediate western frontier. So what happens? Well, the Soviet era comes in, and Stalin is deposed, thank goodness, in 1953, and a fellow named Khrushchev comes in. Now, to assert his bona fides as a real Ukrainian, which he was, he just says, hey, let's make it all one country. Before the Crimea was part of the Soviet Union, we'll put them all together, and it doesn't matter, it doesn't really matter because the Ukraine is part of the Soviet Union, so no problem. That was 1954, okay? Well, now it matters, okay? Now, what am I saying here? I'm saying that it was totally predictable, that if the United States, not using the CIA anymore, but using a CIA front called the National Endowment for Democracy, mind you, funded at $100 million a year, 65 projects in the Ukraine, they're trying to promote democracy, no doubt, and the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, whom I call the prima donna neocona, okay? She's talking to the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, in the Ukraine, and she's saying in an intercepted telephone conversation put on YouTube almost immediately, she's saying, well, you know, we have to go with yachts. Yachts. No. Who's yachts? She didn't even take the trouble to learn how to pronounce his name. It's Yatsenyuk. He was one of the movers and shakers in the European-leaning Ukraine. He happened to be, not coincidentally, head of the central bank. He had all kinds of Western-leaning IMF Wall Street banker-leaning proclivities. And what Victoria Nuland is telling the U.S. ambassador in Kiev is, we're going to pick Yats to be the next prime minister. These other fellows, whom she mentions by name, they can wait in the wings, but Yats is our guy. He knows about the need for austerity, okay? And he's going to do what's necessary to implement the kinds of things that the IMF requires, that Wall Street requires, and move Ukraine toward the West and eventually into NATO. Now, one would have thought that when that intercepted telephone conversation was put on YouTube, which it was 4 weeks before the most recent, quote, revolution in the Ukraine, one would have thought that it would be just a little embarrassing for Yats, you know, Yatsenyuk, and Victoria Nuland, and the U.S., and NATO, to see Yats picked as the new interim prime minister after, quote, 97%, end quote, of the Ukrainians voted for new government against the old government that was duly elected and decided that the elections normally scheduled would be dissed, okay? So, all of a sudden, Yats comes in. I wrote a piece calling, Yikes, it's Yats! Okay. Now, where does he appear? He goes to Washington. He meets with President Obama. And clearly, the game is not over because they like Yats, and Yats has said in public, I am committed to do political suicide by implementing the kind of austerity measures that, for example, Greece is doing in response to the IMF and these pledges and these mortgages and these loans that they have to repay. I will commit political suicide, he says. Whoa, wow, what's he doing? So, in other words, what the neocons tried in this instance, and it could not be clearer, never have I seen an intercepted conversation reflecting what the U.S. has had in mind for the new Ukrainian government. What the U.S. tried to do was a step too far. And what Putin did was entirely predictable. This morning I was reviewing the German press, as I normally do, because it's a lot more enlightening than reading the New York Times or the Washington Post. And I saw that Helmut Schmidt, the Chancellor of West Germany, who, by the way, was hated by the United States because he would not join in what became a war of aggression, and I use that term advisedly, a war of aggression against Iraq. What did he say? Well, he told Die Zeit, not a left-wing newspaper by any stretch of the imagination, he said, look, what Putin did with respect to reincorporating the Crimea was durchaus verständlich, okay? What does that mean? Verständlich is understandable. Durchaus is thoroughly. Thoroughly understandable. And he appealed rather than for sanctions. He said, was wir brauchen, what we need is Zusammenarbeit, zusammen together, Arbeit, working together, zusammenzusetzen, to sit down together, mit Russland, okay, with Russia, and work this thing out. Sanctions aren't going to do it. Threats are not going to do it. We have to act like human, we have to act like mature adults, okay? When problems like this come up, Russia, Germany, United States, and of course the Ukraine, need to sit down and work out an arrangement. My favorite arrangement is the obvious one. Make Ukraine like Finland. Finland is neutral. Does Finland have to be aware of Russian sensitivities? You're darn right it does. Did Finland lose part of its country? It did. But it's prosperous. It's very much part of the West. It's part of the Western economic system. Ukraine could do the same. And that's the obvious solution. All it needs is for our neoconservatives, who not only wish to push NATO still further east, but also wish to create the worst possible atmosphere in U.S.-Russian relationship so that Russia will not cooperate with us as they did on Syria, in pulling President Obama's chestnuts out of the fire when he really faced a terrible situation. The neocons wanted war on Syria. They wanted the U.S. to be involved openly, militarily, and they came within 2 inches of doing that. The Israelis had been told, put your air defenses up. The French fighter bombers were on the tarmac when our president, to his great credit, reversed what John Kerry and the other neocons had said. No, we're not going to fire cruise missiles on Syria, because we could do that tomorrow, we could do that next week, we could do that. There's no time sensitivity here. We're going to go to Congress for appropriate authorization. Now, what happened right after that? Putin and Lavrov, his foreign minister, said, you know, we can help you with this problem. We can persuade the Syrians to take their chemical weapons out of Syria. And, of course, the Syrians came in and said, yeah, we can do that. And the whole thing was diffused. Now, why does that get the neocons angry? Because they very much wanted the U.S. to be involved, because Bashar al-Assad was starting to win that war. And the neocons, well, you know, I've been accused of very early on, this is about 12 years ago, Al McGovern, you know, he's an anti-Semite. Look what he's doing. He's using a code word, neoconservatives. What it really means is Israeli-inclined people, you know, people who give priority, dual citizens, or people who give priority to the interests of Israel over the interests of the United States. That's what it really means. And I tell you, call me naive, but I hadn't really thought of that. And so I took a piece of paper and I jotted down all the names, you know, Wolfowitz and Pearl and all these guys. And I said, holy Moses, McGovern. Most of them, the majority of them, the distinct majority, are of, you know, Jewish persuasion. Some of them are dual citizens. And so, you know, I guess it's easy for people to accuse you of that, but that's the reality. And my definition for a neoconservative is one that is a person like Wolfowitz who cannot distinguish between what they perceive to be the strategic interests of Israel on the one hand and the strategic interests of America on the other. And do I criticize them for that? I do not. I mean, that's everybody's entitled to their own opinion. Do I think they should be running our foreign policy? I do not. I think Obama needs to wake up. And maybe this is a wake-up call for the Victoria Nulands of this world. They're getting Obama into an incredibly embarrassing situation where they're egging him on to create a bad situation with Russia so that no accommodation will work out in Syria. Someone asked a prominent Israeli politician, what's your preferred outcome in Syria? And the answer was, no outcome. And the correspondent said, what do you mean, no outcome? And the person said quite seriously, look, as long as the Sunni, as long as the Shia are at loggerheads, killing each other off, not only in Syria, but in this whole area, well, who benefits? Cui bono? Of course, the state of Israel. Nobody's going to take any pot shots at us when they're fighting one another. So that's the reality here. And that's what I come back to. You know, not only Syria, but the last thing I'll say on this is Iran. Russia was very helpful in helping us work out this agreement where Iran will agree to stop working on the nuclear weapons that they stopped working on in 2003. Now, you're going to really be confused by that. You think, well, McGovern's all mixed up. Well, no. No, the intelligence community in this country unanimously, and as they put it, quote, with high confidence, end quote, decided and issued a national intelligence estimate in November of 2007 saying that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. And has not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. That judgment has been reaffirmed, revalidated, every year since by the entire intelligence community. So is it a little confusing to Americans to say, well, you know, we have to get the Iranians to stop working on a nuclear weapon? Yeah, it is, because our mainstream press is dominated by neoconservatives and our corporations, and they don't want you to know the real truth. But anyhow, long story short, there is an agreement now, an interim agreement between Iran and the Western powers, that Iran will, quote, stop working on a nuclear weapon. And right. And the neocons want to sabotage that. And to the degree they get the Russians against it, so much the better.
Israeli defense minister or some Israeli military-connected official more or less state essentially what's in those NIEs?
Yeah, Tom, you've got a wonderful memory. This is just 2 years ago when General Dempsey, the chairman of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, was going to Israel. And the idea was that he was trying to dissuade the Israelis from attacking Iran before our election. Okay? A big deal, you know. Obama didn't want the Israelis forcing his hand. You know, if the Israelis attacked Iran, it would follow as night the day, okay, or the day the night, that the U.S. would have to be involved somehow to protect Obama's reputation in this country. So what happened was General Dempsey in January 2 years ago, he was going to Israel, and right before he arrived, the Israeli defense minister, okay, he gave an interview to Israeli Defense Forces Radio. Barak was the defense minister's name. And it said, now, Minister Barak, the correspondent said, do you agree with the U.S. intelligence assessment that Iran has not yet decided to build a nuclear weapon? Now, I should explain. That's the gentle way of saying that they stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. You know, the gentle way of saying that, which gets people off the hook, is, oh, they haven't yet decided whether to build a nuclear weapon. Okay, fair is fair. That's not inaccurate. Now, what Minister Barak says, yes, I agree with that. Now, the Israeli Defense Forces radio fellow was a little nonplussed, and he said, well, okay, well, how long will it take the Iranians to build a nuclear weapon if they decide to build one? And what Barak said is really amazing. He said, it doesn't matter. The guy said, it doesn't matter. He says, look, it doesn't matter. Look, the UN inspectors are crawling all over that country, okay? There is no way that Iran could do this without expelling the UN inspectors. When and if they do that, come back and ask me the question. I'll give you an educated answer, but right now, it doesn't matter. Okay, so that's, this was the out of the cat's, what's the word, out of the dog's mouth, right out of the defense minister's mouth in Israel. It's very rare you have a question, have a quote like that, and guess what? It didn't get any play at all in Western media.
Yeah, surprise, surprise.
I'm shocked.
Ray, yeah, me too. Ray, we need to take a very short break for an important message. This is Tom Clamer on Tell Somebody, talking to former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, and we will be right back.
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids' shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media, new public media, now.
Okay, that didn't hurt a bit, did it, folks? This is Tom Clammer. Welcome back to Tell Somebody with Ray McGovern, who will be giving a talk on Ukraine, one regime change too many, at the Ecumenical Campus Ministries, 1204 Oread Avenue, Lawrence, Kansas. Then he's going all over Missouri, and I think a little dip into Arkansas before coming back here, and he will be speaking at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, Monday, April 7th, 6:30 p.m. That's 4801 Main Street in Kansas City. And you can go to kclibrary.org, find the events section, find April 7th, find Speaking Truth to Power, and you can RSVP right there. And Ray, I want to share another little thing from the same paper. I found a Krauthammer thing in. They Star shared a Bloomberg View opinion that reads in part, NATO's flagging European forces, and this is, of course, in connection with Ukraine, NATO's flagging European forces conveyed a message of weakness that could not have been lost on the Russian strongman. To express a new resolve will require reinforcing the foundation of deterrence on which NATO was built. Now, that might be in the foundation someplace. It has always, NATO has always struck me, particularly in more recent years with the Cold War over, as a welfare program for arms manufacturers to profit from. I read something online this morning, and as you know, you're talking here now to a holder of an Estonian passport, and I have a bias towards Estonia, but their president was bragging about austerity, and, you know, listeners to this station know of some pretty good debunking of that whole austerity business by some very well thought of UMKC economists. But he was bragging about that and mentioned that Estonia was fulfilling a NATO requirement that they spend 2% of GDP, I believe it was, on weapons. I mean, this is a lot of money going to that kind of thing. To what end?
Well, Tom, as you mentioned, there are corporate welfare programs, and one of the most amazing ones is described as the anti-ballistic missile defense. Okay? Now, if there were ever a project that was designed to put more money in the pockets of the military-industrial complex, I don't know of it. A anti-ballistic missile system will not work. By definition, there is no responsible scientist or engineer that will tell you that such will work. They're easily defeated by decoys. They're easily defeated by any manner of decoy or other technical means. And so the billions and the billions and the billions that we seek, that we sink into these corporations for this system that will not work, is unconscionable when our schools, when our firefighters, when there are such pressing needs in this country. And that's really, you know, that goes back to what we were saying before. In 1990, there was a chance for peace. I mean, you know, call me a peacenik, but my God, you know, I was pretty mature in those days, and I saw it. The Berlin Wall had fallen. The Russians were willing to deal with us. And for some reason, you know, guess what? Russia was excluded from the new Europe. And not only did NATO expand, but the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was used to circumvent the Security Council in Bosnia, Serbia, but also appears in Afghanistan. I looked at a map recently, and if I have the right country there, Afghanistan doesn't seem to be anywhere near the North Atlantic. And so if I were a Russian looking at all this, I'd say, my God, you know, what's really going on here? And so when the U.S. announced under Bush that they were building anti-ballistic missile systems in Poland and the Czech Republic, but, you know, oh, wait a second now, don't misunderstand. These are not aimed at Russia at all. No, these are aimed at Iran's ICBMs. Oops, wait a second now. But it doesn't have any ICBMs. Well, it might get them, you know, and who knows? Maybe that's an unknown, to quote Rumsfeld. Maybe they have them, you know, just like maybe Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Anyhow, we're going to put them into Poland. We're going to put them into Czech Republic. Well, you know, the Russians aren't dumb. To the degree those things would ever work, they would be designed to give us a leg up on any strategic situation that arose. So, yes, you're right. You called it, I think, a corporate welfare program. That's exactly what it is. It's enriching the pockets of people who don't need the money, while the people in this country are deprived of the peace dividend that could have been ours in 1990. And look what's happening to our infrastructure now when we pay, and I hope, folks, you are aware of this, that we pay half of our discretionary expenditures, or half our tax money, on programs to make us the most powerful military country in the world, and to spend as much as all other countries on the face of this globe, all other countries put together. So unless we face down these fat cats, unless we look at the senators, and there are a couple around here, and the representatives, and there are a couple around here, that are profiteering on all this, that are getting their pockets lined by voting for these defense expenditures, unless we get out in the streets and do some civil disobedience, it's not going to stop, and our children are going to be the ones that suffer.
And I would encourage interested listeners to get on your search engine and type in Ukraine, Monsanto, Cargill. It's not just arms dealers profiting from this, and it's not just arms corporations having far too much influence with the State Department and the executive branch and so forth, as opposed to any kind of democratic interest that they like to proclaim. That's probably too much to get into the weeds on that agribusiness right now. But yeah, you talk about the wasted peace dividend. I was in Estonia for a couple of weeks, September 1989, when they were still in the Soviet Union. I think that was just a couple of weeks before the wall came down,
right,
in Berlin. And they had, one of my relatives handed me a button. It was a map of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania with a chain through it. They had a person holding the next person's hand, human chain, all the way through three countries. That was the kind of level of interest they had in what was going on. And it seemed to be the collapse of the Soviet Union here. In terms of a curiosity, it got some attention, Yeltsin standing on the tank, that kind of thing. But in terms of peace dividend and so forth, seemed to be greeted with kind of a yawn. A huge opportunity, not even talked about in those kinds of terms, except American corporate interests going to Russia to teach them how to rip off the people and serve huge corporate profit interests.
Yeah. Yeah, Tom, again, you put your finger on it here. You know, Yeltsin didn't have too many sober moments, and I mean that in an alcoholic sort of sense. But he did do something really well, and that was to stand on top of that tank. Okay, tanks, but no tanks. No tanks, he's a bad actor. Yeah. I mean, he let all these oligarchs come around. He fashioned this system of a kind of a confederated USSR, which had no prospect of success. And he kind of, and the U.S. kind of saw advantage in letting the whole thing fall apart, because people who were eager to exploit this for financial advantage, the oligarchs, well, they came up, but they would deal with the U.S. and with other Western nations. And so, and this translates to the Ukraine itself. Absolutely no tradition in democratic procedure. Absolutely no leadership that had been cultivated in normal ways that we have in the West. And so they were ripe for plucking. Mm-hmm. Incredibly corrupt people running Ukraine from the earliest times of, you know, until now. And so, yeah, that's part of the problem. But all I'm saying is that, you know, if we really believed in democracy instead of just more wealth accumulation, and there was an opportunity to bring what our founders gave us, you know, to bring those into these really pretty much tabula rasa type of situations where people, you know, were open for this kind of thing. And instead, we brought the corporations, the bankers, and not least the successor to the CIA in overthrowing governments, now called the National Endowment for Democracy.
Indeed. Ray, we've got just about a minute and a half left. Quick comments, anything to people around Missouri and Kansas City that might get to hear you speak, and anything you want to leave with us, including your website?
Well, the website, I'm proud to say, is raymcgovern.com, created by my youngest son. And it's not bad, and he updates it daily, and you'll see most of the things that I say or write or am interviewed about on that. I would say that we haven't really touched on the dispute between the CIA and our Congress, the fact that the CIA has now been accused of subverting the committee that is supposed to be overseeing it. And even though that committee has been mostly overlooking it rather than overseeing it, it's still rather sui generis to see that the CIA seems to think it possible to spy on that committee. That's going to be something that the president has to deal with. And it all has to do with torture, something we didn't mention here. But I know that Errol Morris has a new film coming out. I listened to a little bit of Amy Goodman this morning. Catch that, because here you have the banality of evil. This is at the core of the contest between the CIA and the Congress, because the people still running the CIA are revealed in the Senate report to be implicated in this worst kind of evil, torture, which I was always instructed and educated to know was in the category of intrinsic evil, like slavery, like rape, always, always evil.
Okay, Ray, we're going to have to leave it at that. So much we didn't get to, but I really appreciate having you live in person on Tell Somebody and back in this area. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Tom.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.